Hi, everyone. I'm Lisa.
And I'm Nick.
And you're listening to It Takes Two, the podcast where two people take two movies with the same plot or premise and watch and discuss them.
Are you land lovers? Bend down the hatches. It's two adaptations of Robert Louis Stevenson's 1883's Treasure Island. We were covering off Muppet Treasure Planet from 1996 and Treasure Planet from 2002.
Yep. So two adaptations of Robert Louis Stevenson novels. Oh my god. I separated his name. I said Robert Louis Steven Novelson.
Yeah.
Where there are very few humans.
Very few in both of these. Yes. Yeah. Have you read it?
I have not read it.
Have you read any Robert Louis Stevenson novels?
I don't think I have. What's the other one he's famous?
Kidnapped is the one that I read.
Oh, no, there was another one that he was famous for writing as well. I think Treasure Island is... I mean, we are 100%. I'm going to cut it off right now and say we are definitely going to mix up the words Treasure Island and Treasure Planet multiple
Strange
times.
Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr.
Yes,
Hyde.
Yes, that's what he's written. I don't know if I've read that. I'm more likely to have read that than Treasure Island, I think. Though I feel like we had both books in the house when I was a kid, so I could have read them. But I feel like, no, I don't think I did read Treasure Island. We did have it, but I don't think I ever read it. I kind of mostly just watched a lot of Muppet Treasure Island, and also The Pagemaster goes into it. And I had PC game versions of both of those movies as well, so that was my... Treasure Island knowledge.
Your Treasure Island knowledge was the Muppet movie and the Muppet-based game.
A Muppet-based game and also a Pagemaster game.
Fair. It's interesting because, yeah, you're right about the fact there's very limited human characters. Obviously, the same character archetypes are in both. They're just named slightly different things.
Yeah, it's very interesting to compare characters, I think. I don't know where you'd, because I feel like that's probably what the bulk of this might be, but there's also obviously, you know, changes in story that are made, A, because one is Muppets, and B, because the other is set in space, yeah. though, can I just say I love the aesthetic, I know it doesn't make a lot of practical sense, but I love the aesthetic of just, like, pirate ships sailing through space.
Yeah, so the concept of solar sails... The only bit that arcs me about Treasure Planet is the fact that they can breathe in space.
Mm.
Like, if you had a sail ship that was enclosed in some sort of, like, bome or double
bubble. Yeah, I assume, because they can, like, you know, they've got artificial gravity on the ship. So yeah. I assume that there's supposed to be, like, a kind of an atmosphere around the ship. But then it doesn't make sense how, you know, at one point Jim is off kind of... You know, first of all, the lifeboats don't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But then also there's a bit where Jim has made a makeshift kind of hoverboard and he just like, and it makes sense on a planet, but then he sails off into space and it's like, at what distance does he need to be from that ship before he suffocates? Yeah, so it's a weird concept. Because you could argue that maybe some of the aliens can, you know, don't need atmosphere or air or something, but... He's clearly a human.
I don't know how much you know about aliens, but nothing can survive.
I know, but I'm saying like
you could
say like there's, you know, it's sci-fi, they're taking liberties created an alien species who can do this, you know. But when your main character is a human, you're sending him off into space with no atmosphere.
So there is bacteria apparently growing on the outside of the International Space Station.
That's really cool.
And
scary.
Tardigrades, aka water bears, who've also survived being exposed to the vacuum of space. They're like insane. They're like one of my favorite small things. Mm. All the small things. That's the only bit that really kind of annoys me. I love the aesthetic. I love the fact that they replaced, you know, him having a peg leg with being a cyborg.
Yeah.
The problem is Tim Curry.
The problem is Tim Curry.
His performance is fantastic and makes the rest of the movie look kind of like bad in comparison.
Muppet Treasure Island. It's great. It's great. I have seen someone say, and I think it is so true, and I think about it quite regularly, that the Muppet Christmas Carol works because Michael Caine treats the other Muppets as real actors.
Yeah.
And the Muppet Treasure Island works because Tim Curry treats himself as a Muppet. And, and I think that's what's happening, is that he is like, they're all Muppets? Cool, I'm one too. You know? And so he treats them as his equal, but he's on a different playing field to Michael Caine in Muppet Christmas Carol. I think he's fantastic. But I think the kid is actually really good as well. The kid playing Jim Hawkins.
Kevin Bishop was the actor.
Yeah, Kevin Bishop. I think he's, like, because he was a no one. That's his first film.
Yeah. And I think he continued to be a no one, unfortunately.
Apparently they auditioned hundreds of actors for it, but he had been the first one to audition. So can you imagine you audition, like, hundreds of actors for a role, and then you're like, actually, that first kid was really good. But the Muppets are great. The Muppets are always great.
Yes.
You know, it was Sam the Eagle's first big role in a Muppet movie. He was a fantastic Mr. Arrow.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I think from what I've read in the book, Mr. Arrow is like a drunkard, and he's not really, you know, as honorable as he is in these.
Yeah.
In both of these adaptations, he's like super honorable, super like, you know, strict with rules and things.
Yeah,
he's
keeping everybody in line.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the main plot is identical. Jim gets the map. He gets together with the crew. He's stationed with Long John Silver. They get along, they have fun together, they bond, then a mutiny happens, then they all end up on Treasure Island / Planet,
mm-hmm.
and it's the bond between Jim and Long John Silver that ends up, you know, making them go on a separate ways as sort of like a, you know, I'll see you around kind of material rather than like, next time I'll see you, I'll kill you.
Yeah.
And then no one gets the treasure. Is pretty much the whole thing. It's like, oh,
yeah.
That's the whole thing. Nobody ever gets the treasure. The treasure was the friendship they forged along the way.
There's some interesting parallels in these, in things where they diverted from the book. For example, they both have a love story between the captain and another character, which I don't think Captain Smollett gets a love story in the original book. Certainly not with Ben Gunn, the stray guy stranded on the island.
It was an interesting way to introduce Miss Piggy as the character of, like, the queen of the, like, primitive pigs on the Treasure Island. We've seen quite a few adaptations of this throughout the years under different things.
Mm.
I would say recently... completed Black Sails.
Yeah, relatively recently. Within the last 5 years.
Yeah, which was sort of a prequel-y series with all the same characters. And you see the characters develop along the way. Billy Bones, Captain Flint, and also Long John Silver. It's a very well-rounded story that can go from Muppets to sci-fi animation, because it is animated. There's nothing really that stands out of either movie which was worse than the other than the little nitpicky pieces we've gone over of, you know, how the hell do people breathe in space and space whales, and, well, we didn't mention the space whales, but the space whales.
There's space whales,
yeah.
I genuinely love both these movies. This is, by the way, this is coming out on my birthday, this episode. So this is my birthday present to myself, is that we got to watch Treasure Planet and Muppet Treasure Island. I legitimately really love both of these movies.
Which one do you like more?
I mean, I'm always a Muppet fan. I know Treasure Planet is the better rated film. It also was the bigger flop.
Yeah.
Which I do think that Treasure Planet is one of the most underrated Disney movies. Brother Bear is another one that I really love. And Basil Great Mouse Detective, which was by the same duo who made Treasure Planet. So I think they did Basil, then they did Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Hercules, Treasure Planet, and then Princess and the Frog. So they, yeah, I fantastic duo, Ron Clements and John Lasker. And I don't know. Yeah, I will always have a soft spot for Muppets. I think Muppet Treasure Island will be higher for me in these two, in terms of how much I love it. But Treasure Planet is probably a better film.
Yeah.
But only slightly. I'd say they're pretty on par with each other.
It's been very heavily adapted.
Yeah, of course it has.
So there was... Oh my god.
I mean, I've also seen another animated Treasure Planet, but I don't know if anyone wants us to compare that to anything, or if people even know it exists.
Is it the 86-7 one?
Is that what it was? Is it made of Bulgaria?
So there's...
Is it called Treasure Planet and it's Bulgarian?
No, so there's another one.
Yeah, so I think, was it the 60s? The Bulgarian Treasure Planet?
So, 1982, a Bulgarian animated science fiction adaptation.
Absolutely bizarre. What a weird movie. What an incredibly weird movie. Maybe someday we'll do that Treasure Planet and this Treasure Planet. Because it's literally insane. I've shown you a clip of it, right?
I think so.
I can share the clip of it on our social media. Because I mean, like, it gives you a good indication of how batshit insane it is. I've just remembered that this is supposed to be a child friendly episode, and I hope that wasn't straying us out of child friendly. Anyway, these movies are both great. Do we want to talk? So. Is there much in the story you want to talk about, or do you want to just talk characters and how the characters have been reinvented for these movies?
Because
obviously there's big liberties taken.
So in the story, I feel like there's a little bit more world building in Treasure Planet than there is in Muppet Treasure Island. Yeah. Muppet Treasure Island starts off, Jim's hanging out with Gonzo and...
Rizzo.
They're orphans. They're in the case of, in the care of a tavern owner who's extremely... Well, I don't even know the word. She can hear when her name's taken in vain.
Mm.
Billy Bones is a drunk and... they end up getting the map, and then he basically just runs off. You know, it's his call to adventure. With Jim in Treasure Planet, he's from a loving home where his father left and didn't come back, so he's definitely searching for that father figure.
Yeah.
Which shows when he's why he gets so attached to Long John Silver so quickly.
Yeah.
I don't even think there's his name in the. Treasure Planet.
I think they definitely call him Mr. Silver. Yeah. I think they just call him John Silver. I don't know. I think they might ditch the long part of it.
Yeah. But he's like, he very much reminds me of something I made you watch recently, which is the Kelvin timeline of Star Trek, which is when James T. Kirk's dad is killed and right. Then he becomes a rebellious teenager. And it's very much the same with Jim in the beginning of the movie. When him and his mother are happy, so clearly within this concept his father's still in the picture. He's obsessed with the story of Captain Flint.
Yeah.
Watching like a really cool holographic book of his adventures and the fact that he just like disappeared and, you know, there's a secret that he was like hiding all his treasure from 1,000 worlds on this one planet that no one could find.
Yeah.
And that sort of change is very cool because obviously within the difference between, say, the golden age of piracy in the Caribbean, where a lot of liberties have been taken with the way that people have written stories about piracy, where they were not hoarding it and burying it on islands and making treasure maps and killing the diggers. They were spending it and, like, trying to build their own empire. And... You know, people don't know a lot about piracy outside of Disney, basically. Disney yeah. and adaptations of
But there's
of
this also book. Been, I mean, this is coming from my knowledge of National Treasure more than anything else. But there have been...
Hang on, let me get my National Treasure knowledge out.
There have been so many rumors and stories over the years of treasures, big hoards of treasures that have gone missing. And so there's always going to be this idea of like, oh, what if it's here? What if it's there? You know, there's people going searching caves in Arizona because they think that there might be treasure hidden in there. You
I
know?
Think there's an entire, and I say documentary with air quotes here because it's not really a documentary, like one of those reality TV shows.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's like treasure hunters.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there's more than one, I think.
Yeah, but they're more along the lines of, like, trying to find shipwrecks that had, you know, like, oh, went down here yeah. and we're well, reading is, the logs and this stuff.
Is, and that's the, you know, the beginning of National Treasure is that, yeah. they, is that they're searching Antarctic, or, no, they're searching the Arctic, I'm trying yeah. to think of which one, searching the Arctic. For a ship that would have been where it disappeared, they've the realized that it's
Charlotte.
Yeah, Charlotte, the ship. They realized that, like, you know, with ice caps freezing and melting and refreezing, it's actually way inland.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's this concept of there are these stories of, that have been told about, you know, this person had all this treasure and then they died. Where did it go?
Yeah.
And that's how you end up with stories like Treasure Island, where you're like, you know, well, there was this famous pirate captain and, you know, and he, you know, he killed everyone. And there's a line in Pirates of the Caribbean kind of referencing these stories where, you know, they're saying, oh, you know, and so the stories say that he had killed everyone who knew about it. It's like, well, then who's telling the stories?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very much how it goes in Muppet Treasure Island.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the opening is so cool, and it's like, it's an underrated song for a Muppet movie, which ends with the line, shiver my timbers, shiver my sails, dead men tell no tales, and then it shows Captain Flint shooting the crew.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea is that he killed everyone who knew about where the treasure was. And then it's like, but Long John Silver and Billy Bones and Blind Pew were all on his ship with him. And they clearly know about it. And Billy Bones has the treasure map, you know, and it's like, okay, all these people. And, you know, Ben Gunn is stranded on the island. And in the Muppet version, he's, you know, it's Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
And she's Benjamina Gunn. And then she's got her previous love interest is Captain Smollett. But she also was, you know, had a relationship with Captain Flint, and it's implied that she had a relationship with Long John Silver.
Yeah.
And then in Treasure Planet, Ben is a robot who had his memory pulled out because Flint didn't want him to tell anyone about that he'd booby-trapped the treasure, because in that version, Flint is so bent on keeping the treasure even after he dies that he literally is essentially buried himself in the treasure and set up traps so that no one else can take it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's like, what's the point of the treasure if you're not using it to spend on things and you don't want someone else to have it after you die?
That's a message for all the billionaires in the world.
Yeah.
Spend your treasure to help people.
Genuinely, I mean, that's what Captain Flint is.
Yeah.
Certainly in the Treasure Planet version. He's like a billionaire who's hoarding the wealth and then doing nothing with it.
Yeah. The Goonies.
Goonies, yeah.
The Goonies also has the whole buried treasure under the island thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a very common trope. I mean, I do think, obviously, Robert Louis Stevenson is a big part of any future ones that come out. You know, it's like how Bram Stoker's Dracula has influenced every other vampire story since it was written, you know.
Yeah, because I think they were always very much the same until, I guess, it would have been Anne Rice's novels that really changed vampires within pop culture. Because before, they were always very, like, foreign counts coming to England to prey on, you know, women and, you know, be all spooky and stuff with their, like, you know, telepathy and you know. Because it's got within Renfield, it's Bram Stoker's Dracula, Nosferatu, and it wasn't until, like, obviously later on. But then in saying that Blade, the original comics, was a little bit, obviously it's very different from what we saw on screen. Yeah.
But it's also like, you know, how Tolkien influenced the fantasy genre.
Yeah.
You know, that how many fantasy novels written since The Lord of the Rings have been influenced by The Lord of the Rings, you know?
It's actually fascinating because his novel changed the entire... It's everything. Like, you go back and you boil it all down, it is Tolkien's work.
Yeah.
You know, if you picture an elf in your head, like an elf soldier, they're always using bows, you know, they're always like in the woods, and then dwarves are always like using hammers and axes and are underground and they're big and heavy and they like...
Big long beards. And the women have beards.
And orcs are always like, you know, in the darkness and, you know, scraggly looking. Hodgepodge armor that's not mass produced. It's and that goes into
Dungeons and Dragons,
like Elder Scrolls less with the orcs, but it's very much very like,
yeah, they do try. I think Elder Scrolls tend to go into Norse mythology a little bit as
definitely with Skyrim,
but so did Tolkien dipped into Norse mythology. Anyway, we're getting way off track here, but the point still stands that like a lot of pirate related things you know, from the 1880s onwards, were very much inspired by Treasure Island, because it was kind of the core, you know, well-known pirate book.
Yeah.
And obviously the story is still, you know...
Well, 2014 was when Black Sails came out, and that's the last sort of, like, major adaptation.
People are still interested in it. You know, but the Pirates of the Caribbean series definitely touch on... stuff from
yeah, it's Treasure definitely Island. Within the same sort of, it's not though there are very similarities between the Black Pearl and Treasure Island. They are separate with just the way, but then again we don't know the motivations of the writer who wrote the original ride. Because they were like, oh, you know, can I copy your homework? Yeah, but change it a little bit, kind of, you know.
Well, the ride is just, you go through a town that's where it's all the pirates are spending their money. So it is more like, you know, what you're saying about the golden era of piracy.
Well, there were three, but yeah. There were three
years. Yeah, but it isn't, but there is also then the imagery that we see in Treasure Planet, where you get to a point where it's the skeleton in a, he's, you know, he's hoarded all this gold and then he's a skeleton, he's died, but he's pouring the wine into him, which they use that imagery obviously in the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Barbossa does that, he drinks wine and it goes through. But there is to some extent, even in the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, they're referencing like, you know, oh, and here's the greedy pirate captain who kept all his treasure and, you know, and ended up dying with it, which is very much the kind of Captain Flint idea.
Yeah.
Anyway. Character-wise, I think what you were saying earlier about how much we see of Jim Hawkins, you know, family life in Treasure Planet is interesting, because it's the... don't show it until he's getting to know John Silver.
Yeah.
So there's a lovely montage with a song that appears in my Spotify top 100 every year, I think, where John Silver is putting Jim to work, but at the same time he's feeling proud of him.
Yeah.
And Jim, you know, is doing this kind of half bonding, half rebellion, half work, or, you know, whatever, that's one and a half anyway, with John. But at the same time, it's put alongside clips from his past where it's him waiting on his dad to come back and then, you know, trying to get his dad's attention when his dad does come through, but he kind of just like pats him on the head and walks by. And then, you know, it culminates with, you know, Jim letting down the lifeboat for John Silver to go off, and when he disappears out of frame you see his face change, and then it shows you him waking up and hearing, you know, because he heard, there's no sound in it, there's no diegetic sound in it, but you can assume it's because he heard the door slam.
Yeah.
And he looks out the window and sees his dad heading towards a boat, and he runs down. His mum is crying downstairs, and then he runs out and he gets to the pier right as the boat is taken away, and it's the last, you know, presumably the last time he saw his dad.
Yeah.
And then John Silver comes back for him and takes him away with him on the boat, and it's the, you know, he has made the link in his own mind, oh, this is, you know, he's started to trust this guy and see him as a father figure, and then he's like, oh, he's gonna leave me too.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he goes, oh, he won't. You know, and whereas in Muppet Treasure Island, what they have is a conversation where it shows you not so much that Jim sees John Silver as a potential father figure, but that John Silver sees himself in Jim.
Yeah.
Which is when Jim, you know, when he goes to, Long John Silver goes to dangle the compass over the edge of the water because he's trying to teach him to navigate by the stars and said, and Jim gets upset and he says, that's my, you know, that's my father. It's the only thing I have of him.
Mm.
So Long John asks him when his father died. He said he was 7. And then Long John says, I was 8 when my father died.
Yeah.
And my father was a first mate, or was that right? First mate, I think.
Yeah.
And then Jim's like, so was mine. And they realize that, like, to some extent, they are each other. And I think in both movies, they kind of do show you that Long John Silver sees enough of himself in Jim that he knows that Jim could turn out to be like him, and that he doesn't necessarily want Jim to turn out to be like him.
Yeah.
And in both, but in both, he does at some point try to convince him to, like, oh, you know, you can come do the pirate life with me. Once Jim knows that he's a pirate, but ultimately, I think he's happier that Jim doesn't choose that life, because he knows that that's, you know, the life that he's chosen for himself. He's put himself on the run constantly, and, you know, and he would rather Jim get to have a life that he didn't get to have.
Yeah. It's very interesting because, like, you can't really, obviously one, science fiction, but, like, even with that and that, there's sort of, like, no time placement of it, because it's, like, the, I think the last age of piracy, well, especially in the Caribbean, that was like Blackbeard's era, so Edward Teach.
Right.
It's.
And that is around when Treasure Island's supposed to be set, right? Cause,
yeah.
Because Flint was supposed to be a contemporary of Teach.
Yeah.
So Treasure Island's supposed to be set slightly after.
Yeah, so it's 1715 to 1726.
Right.
There was the golden age of piracy. So that was when it was, like, uncontrolled.
Yeah.
So, 1650 to 1730. So it was actually a decent time.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, that was rather, that was in the Americas anyway.
Which is where, because in Treasure, Muppet Treasure Island, and obviously Treasure Island the book, they're setting sail from Bristol in the UK, but they're heading towards the Caribbean.
Yeah.
So it is kind of the same thing, or like the same area. Apparently, in the book, Billy Bones mentions 1745 in his log dates on the treasure maps. So the movies, or the book, is supposed to take place between around 1757 to 1762. So it is a little while after the golden age of piracy, which makes sense because, it, you know, they're not expecting everyone to be pirates, and they're going to dig up treasure that was left by pirates.
Do you know how long Edward Teach, aka Blackbeard, so you know the character, right?
Yep.
Do you know how long he was a pirate for?
Like 5 years or something.
From 1716 to 1718.
2 years.
So it was two, yeah.
And then if Our Flag Means Death is to be believed, he then was just in a relationship with another former pirate.
Yeah.
Benjamin
Hornigold was another pirate who's pretty famous.
Yeah, he's in Black Sails as well.
Yeah, so Hornigold, Charles Vane, Black Bart, Calico Jack, Henry Morgan's, well, famous for other reasons, but they're, you know, these were all real people.
Yeah.
Anne Bonny, another famous pirate. Very, very few famous female pirates, unfortunately. Mary Read, obviously the other one. It's a very interesting genre because it is sort of this weird love affair of a time that had long passed, even when, you know, the book was written.
Yeah, yeah. So the book, it's set about 100 and something years before the book
was written. And you sort of have to wonder what, like, things are going to come out from our culture about times in the past. Mm. And you see it a lot with science fiction in the very least. Maybe not so much with contemporary stuff, but you do feel like even Star Trek has a very sort of like native, because they are starships, so they're very much like on a naval sort of thing. And you could say that, like, in early Star Trek, you have the captain of the ship and his first mate, and then they're going off on these adventures, and then, you know, Klingons, you could claim as pirates, because they're very much about honor within themselves, and they're warriors, and, you know, and it's, I think even though, you know, it's over 300 years ago, the legacy of these people, the legacy of this era is really carried forward in pop culture, and the way we tell stories and the type of stories we tell, they're still very relevant.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's such an interesting thing to be so, like, you know, do you have adaptations of these that carry so much weight, even though, you know, you can change the story by having characters being Muppets or having them as,
yeah,
you know, cyborgs in the future.
And I think the relationship between Jim and Long John Silver is part of that.
Yeah.
100%. I think that, well, obviously, you know, the concept of piracy or an adventure, you know, this like young kid going off on this huge adventure to see the world and things like that is, you know, something that's always going to resonate with people. But I think the reason why this particular story is so adaptable and you can change it into, you know, whatever setting you want to and it still works is because it's very much about that central relationship between this kid who doesn't have a dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And this guy who sees potential, but also he sees the potential for good and the potential for bad of the kid. And I know in, you know, Muppet Treasure Island, we don't necessarily get as much of the potential for bad because he is kind of, you know, almost like a goody-two-shoes little kid. And he's a bit younger and a bit more naive. Whereas in Treasure Planet, he's already being arrested.
Yeah.
You know, he's already kind of a little bit of a delinquent.
Yeah.
You know, he's already kind of going down the wrong path. And you know that he doesn't want to be, because he has that moment where he's like, I'm going to, you know, finally, I have something that's going to help me change how people see me.
Yeah.
You know, and make people look at me and realize that, you know, I'm not all these bad things. And in both, you know, especially Treasure Planet, he's definitely got like a lot of potential. He's an intelligent kid. You know, he actually gets on well with people when he tries. I mean, I know in Muppet Treasure Island, he's easily getting along with everyone, whereas in Treasure Planet, he's a, you know, there's an edge to him, but when he actually lets his walls down, he gets on with people really well. And he's like, in that one, he's very technically minded and he's very good at, you know, robotics and shipbuilding and, you know, all sorts of kind of things, and a very quick learner. I think he's a quick learner in both. And, you know, and there is so much potential for him to go and put good into the world and, you know, do something worthwhile with his life. But there's also potential for him to end up exactly like Long John Silver.
Yeah.
And I think that just like core central story could be put into any setting.
Yeah.
It doesn't even necessarily need to be pirate related, but the pirates are fun.
Treasure related.
Yeah. It's just some kind of, you know, an adventure where he gets to grow into himself.
Yeah.
And discover what his own potential is. I think a lot of people will see themselves in that.
Yeah. I agree with you. Do you want to cover off some tidbits little bits of
yeah. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Not particularly. Maybe something will pop up while you're talking.
Muppet Treasure Island. So I just took note of who wrote the songs because I love the songs in this movie. So they're written by Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, who also worked together on An American Tale, which also has good songs. Apparently after shooting Wrapped, the studio gifted Tim Curry with a Muppet version of himself as Long John Silver, which is very cute.
Yeah.
This I thought was very funny. So, you know, when there's a kind of native pigs on the island.
Yeah.
And the first one we meet, his name is Spa-Am.
Yeah.
Hormel Foods Corporations, the makers of Spam, sued the production company for having a warthog named Spa-Am. And they lost their lawsuit, but the judge made a note in the deliberation. What he said was, one might think Hormel would welcome the association with a genuine source of pork. That was very funny. Kevin Bishop, who plays Jim Hawkins, went through puberty and his voice broke during filming. So a lot of his singing is overdubbed with like older recordings they had of him practicing the songs.
Right.
So just as well, they had the older versions of it. I mentioned that he was the first person to audition, and they did hundreds of actors, and he ended up getting the role. This was made apparently after the success of Muppet Christmas Carol. The Jim Henson Productions decided that they wanted to cast Kermit and his friends in another period piece, and apparently the screenwriter said it had been a toss-up between an adaptation of Treasure Island or a take on King Arthur. So we almost ended up with a Muppets Camelot movie instead.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Also, originally, Jim Hawkins wasn't going to be a human in it. They were going to split the role, like they did with Marley in Muppet Christmas Carol. They were going to split the role in two and have Gonzo and Rizzo play characters named Jim and Hawkins as two separate characters.
Right.
But then they realized that, like I was just saying, the story is very, the core of the story is very much about this young boy's experiences.
Yep.
And they were like, no, we need to keep the boy in it. And they just put Gonzo and Rizzo kind of as themselves.
As themselves.
Tim Curry modeled his accent and his voice on his own grandfather, who was a sailor.
Just to say a pirate.
Yeah, but maybe. Yeah. It says seafaring. So he just basically did an impression of his own grandfather for the movie. Cute. And Sir Billy Connolly takes great pride in being the first person to die on screen in a Muppet movie as Billy Bones. For Treasure Planet, it seems like it was in production hell for a very long time. So it said on it that the movie took 10 years to make, which is the longest production cycle of any movie in Disney's experimental era, which is that...
Yeah.
You know, era after their kind of Disney Renaissance. But I think it was longer than that, really, because apparently it was pitched to the makers before they did, or while they were working on Basil the Great Mouse Detective.
Right.
Which came out in 86.
That's a long time.
Yeah. So, and then they kept being given other movies to do, and eventually when they were told that they were going to work on Hercules, they were like, we're only going to do Hercules if we can finally do this Treasure Planet movie afterwards.
Because that's that old tale about people who were failing at their jobs on Prince of Egypt, eh? They got Shrek.
They got put on Shrek.
They had to go work on Shrek.
Yeah. No, I mean, these guys made, like, the duo made fantastic movies.
Yeah.
You know, I think every one of the movies they've made has been really good. But they eventually were like, listen, we're only going to do Hercules if you let us finally do this movie afterwards. So the production mainly started after the release of Hercules. The look of the movie was based on 19th century oil paintings.
Yep,
which is cool.
Yeah, you can see it. Very yellow.
It was the first feature film to release simultaneously in regular theaters and IMAX theaters, which is interesting. The human characters in it are hand-drawn. John Silver's cyborg leg, arm, and eye and Ben are all flat-rendered CGI. And then they used a process called Deep Canvas to create the ship. So in some scenes, all three types of animations appear simultaneously, which is really interesting. They've got, like, just multiple different kinds of animation. It is the most expensive traditionally animated film ever made. It cost $140 million to make it, and then they had another $40 million for advertising, but had a total worldwide gross of $101 million, so it lost about $80 million. So it is, I think, well, this was up until, this was written in 2011. It was Disney's biggest financial loss. I feel like they probably haven't had a bigger one since, but it's hard to tell in the era of streaming services, you know, how much money certain films have made, especially ones that were, you know, during the COVID pandemic that were released straight to streaming services. So it might not be the biggest loss anymore, but it certainly would still be up there.
Yeah, because they had a planned sequel for Treasure Planet.
Yeah. So when they, I can't remember who it was, when they brought in someone as head of the studios, would have been Bob Iger? I don't know. Anyway, at some point they brought in someone as head of the studios, and the first job he was given was to axe any sequels in production or in planning, which is why it never got a sequel. And the other bit of trivia that I took down, which I thought was interesting, is that at the end of the movie, so Dr. Doppler and Captain Amelia have got children at the end of the movie. Apparently, they had to cut some lines from the movie that had revealed that it was Dr. Doppler who gave birth to the children. because Disney themselves ordered that they cut it because they thought that having a male give birth, even an alien, was too risque for a children's movie. So they didn't want... I mean, male seahorses give birth. I don't think it's that weird. I watched this as a kid and I wouldn't have been weirded out.
Yeah.
I would have been like, oh, he had the babies. But Disney were like, nope, you cannot include these lines that say that a man gave birth to these children. But they didn't put in any line to say otherwise. Yeah. So I think canonically,
it's still happening.
Canonically, Dr. Doppler is the one who gave birth to those babies at the end.
Yeah.
Which is fun. Yeah, that's all the trivia I had taken down anyway.
Alrighty. What do we normally do at the end of the trivia?
Sometimes we do budget and box office, but...
Yeah, we've already sort of covered that.
Yeah, I didn't look at the budget and box office of Muppet Treasure Island.
I think it was a 74 million cost, but there's no box office to it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Did it not get a theatrical release?
I'm not sure.
I definitely had it on VHS as a kid. I imagine it did... amazing numbers in VHS sales.
Yeah. Because that was that whole thing, and that's something that I've realized that's shocked me recently.
Mm.
Unless you go to, like, even I'm going to JB Hi-Fi, for those who don't know, is like a, you know, it's a very much like electronics, records, CDs, DVDs, games, headphones, that kind of thing, you know, that big everything in there. Their DVD selection has shrunk so massively.
Yeah.
We were in two warehouses recently. For those who don't know, warehouses like Target.
Yeah, kind of like Target.
They don't even have them as a section anymore.
Yeah, that really surprised me.
And it's very much just gotten down rid of to, DVDs yeah, entirely. Very much down to streaming services like destroying that entire market. And it really concerns me because streaming services are now eating itself, being that you can't get everything you want on one streaming service, so you either end up having to have multiple subscriptions, which are then expensive. The attitudes that certain studios within those streaming services are taking, which they're going, oh, cool, we're not doing anything complicated and we're just making schlock from now on because that's what people watch the most of, therefore it gives us the most watch time, therefore it's the most popular, and therefore we must create more of that.
Yeah.
Where I feel like Apple TV, on the other hand, are doing the opposite of that and making really interesting niche stuff, and it's very difficult at this time that we probably won't get any more, what's the word? straight to DVD spin-offs of big movies that don't have the budget to make another movie, like Aladdin, for an example. You won't get any revitalization within the genre like we had with Firefly, and because of the DVD sales did so well, we got the Serenity movie. And I feel like that's really...
It's because everything's going straight to streaming.
Yeah.
Those kind of things are just on Netflix or on Disney Plus. You don't
need to see,
or...
Avengers movie. You just wait 3 months and it's for free on bloody Disney Plus.
Well, it's not for free. You're paying it.
Well, yeah.
More and more of a subscription every year.
Yeah.
I can't find the budget for Muppet Treasure Island, but it made $34 million in box office, which adjusted for inflation is $83.7 million.
So it lost as well.
Well, I can't find anything to say a budget for it anywhere.
Okay, because I looked on Wikipedia and I said the budget of it.
What?
I
only see the box office on Wikipedia.
Oh, maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing then. Hang on. Not that I don't believe you. I don't believe you. It's box office of... It says $47 million on here.
Oh, well, I don't know what that's coming from. I've found multiple other sources that say $34 million as a box office.
Strange.
Anyway, so I don't know how much it cost. But, you know, that's a decent amount. I mean, that's not including, as you mentioned, VHS sales.
Yeah.
Which it would have made a lot in, I think.
Yeah, because they were... VHSs were expensive back in the day.
And Muppet movies typically do pretty well. And Disney movies and Muppet movies do well in VHS sales. I think Treasure Planet may have been the last Disney movie to be released on VHS.
Because then they went to DVD.
Yeah. I think Treasure Planet at least would have been one of the first that was released on both VHS and DVD. I know we had Emperor's New Groove on VHS, which might have been after. It's certainly, I think it was the last of the Ron Clements, John Musker films to be released on VHS. I don't know. Yeah, somewhere around that era is when they rolled up. So it would have been still while they were releasing on both DVD and VHS. So I think, I'm not sure whether we had Treasure Planet on VHS or DVD. Maybe that might have been one that we had both. Emperor's New Groove, we had VHS. Which is around the same time.
Right.
But then I think Meet the Robinsons, we only had DVD.
Fair.
Brother Bear, I think, was only DVD. Anyway, so somewhere around that era, they cut off. So, it could have done fantastic sales, Treasure Planet.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's considered a huge financial loss for Disney. Which is a shame, because it's a fantastic movie. And it still lives up. I mean, like, if you look at... Because here's the thing. It's considered Disney's experimental era, because it was when they were, like, doing bits and pieces of CG and, hand-drawn, whatever. Of all of those movies, this one has probably aged the best in terms of CGI. Like, it still looks incredible. I don't think it looks dated at all.
Yeah,
I think it looks beautiful.
Most people who have listened to this podcast know my argument between practical effects and CGI.
But it's an animated film.
Yeah, and I think that's where that... you haven't seen Reboot.
No.
That looks awful now.
But, like, Meet the Robinsons, which is a film I love, and I still love the story of it, but if you look at the CG in Meet the Robinsons, that is massively dated by now.
Atlantis? Was it Into the Wild?
Oh my god, well, yeah, that's bizarre. That's ridiculous. Chicken Little was around then as well, and that's also kind of dated. So it was more stylized, which I think helps to keep it not date so much. And that was the difference between The Wild and Madagascar. That Madagascar was very stylized, so it kind of kept its look, whereas, you know... But it's like if you look at the first Toy Story movie versus Toy Story 3 or Toy Story 4, and it's like a massive, wild world of difference. But I genuinely think this movie, which was, 2002?
Yeah.
Completely holds up. I think the CG in it looks fantastic still.
Yeah.
I think they did a really good job blending those animation styles.
The blending is the main part, and they did really, really well. It's still thoroughly enjoyable, even, with my dislike of CGI in things,
Yeah, I mean, the solar sails and the ship itself all being kind of a, with the deep canvas thing and the cyborg parts and the robot parts all being CG on a, either on this deep canvas ship or on a hand-drawn background, and it still looks fantastic to this day. I think that, for an experimental film, incredible work. I do think Atlantis does a decent job as well, which is around the same time. I think it's 2001. If you watched Dinosaur, which was another Disney film from that era, that looks terrible. So it was hit and miss. But I think, this is one that's slept on. I think people don't talk about Treasure Planet enough. It doesn't get as much love as it should, but it's an incredible film. And it's a really good adaptation, that they kept the core story and kept a lot of elements, that are in the book. They've actually stuck to a lot of it.
Yeah.
But put it in this sci-fi world and with all these experimental animation styles and managed to make something that is still beautiful, 20 odd years later.
And of course, Muppets are always practical.
Yeah, Muppets are great. Yeah. and Tim Curry, perfection in that movie. He's so good. He's just so good.
He's great.
He considers that one of his favorite films, apparently, that he's been in. Which, if I was in that movie, I would also consider it. I think he's incredible in it. And the songs, the music in both films is great. That's another thing we should shout out. The music in both films is great. Very little in the way of songs in Treasure Planet, because it's not necessarily a musical Disney film. Some of them are very much musical, some of them are not. It does have that one song that we talked about over the montage, but then the rest are just in the end credits, whereas Muppet Treasure Island has got so many songs.
Yeah.
And they're very funny, and the lyrics are just wonderful. Like, you could watch that movie a dozen times and hear something new in the lyrics of the songs each time and be like, oh, I didn't even notice that last time. And there's definitely, we won't go into the details of them, there's definitely jokes and references in Muppet Treasure Island that are put in there for the adults watching. 100%. As well.
Like, no child going into that movie is going to know who Henry Kissinger is.
Yeah. So there's a few very funny jokes that are quite subtle most of the time, but are funny for adults, and the kids won't get them at all. Until they're older and they rewatch it and they go, ha ha ha, didn't notice that when I was a kid. So it's definitely a movie that's, I think both are movies that are suitable for, that are, enjoyable for adults to watch. So they're both movies that are good for kids, but also very enjoyable for adults to watch.
Talking of enjoyable for adults to watch, if you've enjoyed this episode, please join us on our Discord, and you can find every link to everything on our website, ittakes2.co.nz.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us on this lovely adventure into the high seas of treacherousness and mutiny and family-ness.
We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.